joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The blockbuster movie Jurassic Park was based on the idea that dinosaurs could be resurrected using DNA extracted from a mosquito preserved in amber. Science has not evolved that far yet, but in the very near future, scientists may be able to build a dinosaur from a chicken embryo. Jack Horner is professor of paleontology at Montana State University. James Gorman is with the New York Times, and together they write about this scenario in a new book. It's titled How to Build a Dinosaur. Both Jack Horner and Jim Gorman join me in the studio. I look forward to having you join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Nice to have you both here. Jack, is this all speculation or is this a real possibility that we could sometime in the near future build a dinosaur?
Well, Diane, that's an interesting question. You know, birds already are dinosaurs. The new way we classify dinosaurs actually puts birds as dinosaurs. We call them avian dinosaurs. And so the big extinct clunky ones we call non-avian dinosaurs. So since a chicken already is a dinosaur, it doesn't take much to make one.
How did a chicken evolve from a dinosaur, Jim?
Well, that's pretty much the key to being able to take a chicken embryo and make it grow so that it comes out essentially looking, for all intents and purposes, like a dinosaur. We used to think that evolution occurred by many, many small changes, so that if you looked at the genes in a chicken, they would be incredibly different from the genes in, say, a T-Rex, just as human genes would be incredibly different from chimpanzee genes. Now we find that's not the case at all. Humans and chimpanzees share 98% or more of their genes. And the new notion of how evolution occurs, which is called Evo-Devo, sounds like a rock band, but it stands for evolutionary
or
development.
Is
that you have some master control genes that kind of turn on whole suites of instructions, a whole set of instructions. And if you just adjust those genes, or even the products of those genes, which are chemicals called growth factors, in a growing embryo, you can rewind the tape of evolution and then go run it back again the way it was before, so that, for instance, in a tail, instead of the tail growth stopping, you find where the switch is that stops that tail program, you turn it off.
You turn it off. And so you begin the process of rearranging within those genes the signals.
Yeah, I think, you know, from a simple point of view, if you're just watching the embryo grow in the egg, the embryo starts growing a tail. The chicken embryo starts growing a tail. And it starts out with a five-fingered hand. And after a point in time, this gene kicks on that disintegrates the tail. I mean, that's basically what happens. And then another gene turns on that gets rid of two of the fingers, leaving it with three. And then somewhere along the way during the embryo growth, those three fingers actually fuse together to form a wing. So theoretically, you'd only have to find that one gene that disintegrates a tail and stop that from happening, and then leave this embryo with a three-fingered hand instead of a wing. So theoretically, two switches or something like that, you'd at least have an aesthetically looking dinosaur, right? You'd have a chicken with a long tail and hands instead of wings.
And dinosaurs had feathers, so.
Dinosaurs had feathers.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about they certainly had this sort of comb-like feature on the top of their head. But what are you talking about?
Oh, they had feathers all over the body, and they feathers on their arms. And it goes back, they're finding more and more kinds of dinosaurs that had feathers.
But little dinosaurs.
Okay, and what purpose did those feathers serve back then? Do we know?
Well, a little dinosaur would... Dinosaurs are warm-blooded. The extinct ones were warm-blooded, and the live ones are warm-blooded. And so a small animal that is warm-blooded requires some kind of insulation to keep the heat in. So insulation is probably certainly one of the reasons, but then display is also another reason. And, you know, we see in modern birds a lot of feathers that are display feathers. Peacocks have wonderful display features, feathers. And dinosaurs probably had those as well. And the ones that actually go down the back probably are display feathers.
Jack Horner, he and James Gorman together have written a new book. It's called How to Build a Dinosaur. Extinction Doesn't Have to Be Forever is the subtitle. And on the cover is a rather large three-fingered claw emerging from a rather thick-shelled egg. Really a fascinating concept. I do invite your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jack, I know you do most of your work at Hell Creek Formation. Tell us about that.
Well, currently what we're trying to do is we're working on a big project we call the Hell Creek Project. And the whole idea was to get a good grasp of how many different kinds of dinosaurs there were just before dinosaurs went extinct. And so we've been doing this for, this will be our 11th year this year, and we have made huge collections of dinosaurs like T-Rex and Triceratops and duckbill dinosaurs and so forth. And, you know, we're learning a lot of stuff about extinct dinosaurs.
And that area apparently is quite well known going back far? As far as the collection of dinosaur bones?
Barnum Brown was collecting there in the early 1900s. He found the first Tyrannosaurus rex there.
And when did the idea of digging up bones shift to the idea of digging into bones?
That was the year 2000. While we were excavating one of our T-Rexes, we had a little difficulty getting it out of the field. It was
rather large.
It was large, and we were in an area where there were no roads, so everything had to be helicoptered in and helicoptered out. And so we had a specimen that we had packaged up in the plaster jacket, and the helicopter couldn't lift it. And so we had to divide it in two pieces. We actually had to break one of the bones in half.
Which must have distressed you greatly initially.
Well, not really. I'm in the business of looking inside of bones anyway.
Okay.
So I don't mind. You know, glue is cheap. You know, I figure, you know, looking inside, you always have the possibility of finding something new. So we don't worry too much about breaking things as long as we know we can glue them back together again.
So then you began looking inside the broken bones.
Well, I had a former graduate student named Mary Schweitzer, who her dissertation, her doctoral dissertation, was about looking inside the bones for anything and, you know, something that might be in there. I have a laboratory just dedicated to actually looking at the microstructure, the cellular level of dinosaurs. And Mary was interested in taking that down a notch and looking at the molecular level. And so when we broke that bone open, we sent samples to Mary, and Mary found two very interesting things. The first thing she saw was some unusual kind of bone in the marrow cavity of the dinosaur, which turned out to be a substance we call medullary tissue. And medullary tissue is only found in pregnant birds, which meant that our T-Rex was a female. It's actually the calcium that's built up to form the egg. And another thing she found, she did something that was very unusual. Modern biologists take modern bones all the time and they decalcify them so that they can get to the tissue. But no one had ever really thought about doing that to a fossil bone because, as we all know, it's petrified and therefore, you know, all the dissolving in the world shouldn't produce anything. But Mary dissolved the bone away and there were blood vessels.
And we're going to hear more about those blood vessels from Jack Horner. He's professor of paleontology at Montana State University. And just before the break, Jack Horner, professor of paleontology at Montana State University, was talking about the work of one of his graduate students, Mary Schweitzer, who was beginning to look within the bones of a dinosaur, realized it was a female dinosaur, realized that the dinosaur indeed had been pregnant, and ultimately, I gather, Jack got to the blood vessels.
She found flexible blood vessels and then began doing some other extractions and has actually been able to extract proteins from this dinosaur. And so, you know, really working at the molecular level, finding some very interesting tissues, but not enough to actually make a dinosaur. So if we're going to make a dinosaur, we have to find another avenue.
I see. Now, for you, Jim Garman, this whole project must have been absolutely fascinating.
It's amazing. It's when we started to write the book, or when the idea sort of came up, I was sitting talking to Jack. We were thinking about what we might write, and as we have done often. And Jack held up the skeleton of a chicken that he keeps near his desk, and he said, you know, well, look at that. And he said, what's the difference between that and a dinosaur? And I, you know, tried to figure out the answer. And he said, well, you know, we can change that. We can make a dinosaur. And I said, no, we can't. And he said, yes, we can make a dinosaur. And he proceeded to tell me, you know, how it can be done. So this seemed like just an amazing idea and something to start on and also something to challenge people with, to say, look, we can do this. Let's try this. And also, should we do it? You know, to get the book out there and stir up some controversy, have people start talking about it.
Well, and that's one of our first emails from Robert in Hollywood, Florida, who says, other than to prove we can do it, what would be a reason to create a dinosaur? What benefits would there be to humanity? And would this be fair to the animal? How do you respond to those?
I mean, those are all excellent questions. I think that from a scientific point of view, the most important thing that you would do if you were to create a dinosaur is you would connect evolution at the molecular level, you know, small changes in biochemicals, to evolution at the grand level. We have, in the laboratory, scientists have watched, you know, fruit flies and bacteria evolve, and they've seen small changes in genes. We know all about this. And paleontologists have seen the grand sweep of evolution, where you have, you know, T-Rex, and you have mammals appearing, birds, you have, you know, grand changes. But there have only been little stabs at trying to connect what's called microevolution to macroevolution and really show how that can be done. And if you could do that just with the tail, for instance, you would show how a major structural change in animals occurred at a molecular level. And you would be running the tape of evolution backward and forward and showing how it worked. It would be a really fundamental thing to demonstrate. And the interesting thing about doing it this way is that it would be powerful both in a scientific way to demonstrate it to scientists, because they could see all the details of what was done, and it would be tremendously powerful to show it to people, to the average person, because you can talk all you want about how evolution proceeds, but if you could show them a chicken that, to all intents and purposes, is a dinosaur, and then say, explain how it happened, and say, what is this? How would you explain this without evolution? I mean, you have a very powerful tool there. So knowledge and the ability to convince people are two reasons.
I would like to also say something to Robert. You know, once we understand how to turn genes on and turn genes off and have a good understanding of that, it is going to help us solve a lot of genetic problems as well. I mean, there are a lot of genetic diseases out there that would be really handy to know how to turn, you know, which genes to turn on and off. So anything we learn about genetic switching is going to be useful.
What about the whole question of ethics, however, as we see these genetic changes being manipulated by human beings? Is there a sense that maybe we're fooling with Mother Nature? Evolution evolved from the beginning of time to now. Who are we as human beings to begin fiddling with that and maybe turning the clock back?
Well, you know, first off, pollution messes with Mother Nature.
You bet.
So that's us messing with Mother Nature.
Human beings, exactly. Again.
Exactly. But, you know, when it does come down to what we do and what we don't do, obviously someone has to make that decision.
As to whether to go forward
to
with
it.
Something
Absolutely.
Like that.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, the simple fact of the matter is that we are already messing with Mother Nature in many ways, and it's for good purposes and bad purposes. And some of the things that we do, we create mice that are prone to diabetes or Alzheimer's. Just the breeding of different kinds of cats and dogs and fish, we are fooling with evolution all the time. And in this case, to start out, you would only be adjusting the growth of one individual by inserting some chemical growth factors. You wouldn't have to change the genes. So genetically, that would still be a chicken. I think the question of whether it's fair to the animal is interesting,
it's
too.
It's a good one.
And the answer is that if this were to go beyond, when you're working with an embryo in the egg, you're doing what people are doing all the time. I mean, embryologists have fiddled with chicken embryos growing, giving it an extra wing, this, that, the other thing, but not hatching them, because then you're essentially working with something that's not aware, that hasn't, you know, come out of the egg. It's not walking around. If you were to hatch the creature, which would be a chicken and a dinosaur, then all sorts of things would come into play. All universities have animal experimentation policies and committees that would look at this. You know, would have to be a public discussion. And the issue was simply, if you can do this right, if you're not, you know, you could fiddle with the embryo and just create a freak, and that would be, I think, unethical to hatch it. But if you can do it right, you're creating a functioning animal. And so this animal is not going to be experiencing pain, and it's going to be able to eat and function and move in ways that are perfectly adequate. So those things certainly have to be considered, but I think they would be.
You know, all of a sudden I was thinking about dog breeding and the way that is changing. I've just heard about a dog called a Puggle, a cross between a beagle and a pug. Now, to what extent is what you're doing similar to what happens when you crossbreed a beagle with a pug?
I don't think it's that similar, actually, because this chicken, at first, of course, we're not talking about changing the genes again. So you're coming with you're having a dinosaur that is genetically a chicken. What you've adjusted is when the control genes would, say, send out a lot of a certain protein called Sonic Hedgehog, right? You don't have to change the gene. You can say, okay, I'm going to get some Sonic Hedgehog from this laboratory, and I'll put it in these little microbeads, and I'll open up the embryo, and I'll stick them in right here because I've learned exactly where it has to be, and that'll make the tail grow. We hope. And it has done to a certain extent. There needs to be some more work. And we're in a tradition here. Aristotle watched chickens grow. He was the first embryologist, really. And forever, people have been using chickens because the eggs are widely available, and they're so easy to work with. You can cut a window in an egg, essentially, and still, you know, leave some of the membrane there. You can watch the process happen, I mean, with the naked eye. This is so much easier than dealing with mammals and other creatures. So, you know, I think it's just an amazing opportunity, really.
How far do you want to take this experimentation, Jack?
I would like to see a chicken with a long tail and a hand.
And would that satisfy you?
Well, I'm not trying, you know, the whole idea really is to see if we can revive some ancestral conditions. But even one condition would be pretty cool.
But, you know, you're young enough.
A long tail.
To want to see what happens after you get a longer tail and what happens after you see a hand with three fingers.
Oh, do I want to see a T-Rex? Is that what you're asking
me?
Yes,
I think
if I were going to make if I had the capability of making a dinosaur, I'd make a friendly one.
How would you do that?
Well, I don't know how I would do that.
But you think that But evolutionary biology could help you in that regard, to not only create the body, the shape, the infrastructure, but to affect the behavior.
Well,
that's a good. I was just teasing mostly.
Yeah, I know you were.
I actually think you could. For instance, you can tell which dinosaurs are plant eaters and which are predators. Now, if you were to try to recreate a really fast, really successful predator with really dangerous claws and teeth, well, I think that would go on the non-friendly side.
That probably would.
If, however, you were to create an animal that you know hung around in herds and chewed on bushes, that's probably going to be a lot more friendly.
You know, I heard the other night about farm-raised whales, and I found myself being appalled, as though we really are messing with Mother Nature. And it just gives me pause. I understand your intellectual curiosity and that it would take you as far as you could ethically go, because I assume the two of you are ethically thinking human beings. But, you know, farm-raised whales?
Well, the real issue here is that it doesn't matter how moral Jack and I are, because these things are decided in political and social discussions. And, you know, all kinds of science things are debated. You know, we've had stem cell debates going
on.
These are not things that scientists get to decide for themselves, and that's correct.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones. If you'll put headphones on, we'll take a couple of calls here. If you've just joined us, Jack Horner and James Gorman have together written a book titled How to Build a Dinosaur. Extinction doesn't have to be forever. Let's go to Harrington, Delaware first, and to Nancy. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. First, may I say that I thoroughly endorse their project, or their projected project, because we can learn a lot about gene expression and gene control. But I am in my 60s, and I need a review. I need Dinosaurs 101. I was brought up to assume that dinosaurs were reptiles related to alligators and crocodiles. And now I think you're saying to me I should be thinking more in terms of ostriches and emus. And also, did the T-Rex have feathers?
Jack.
All very good questions. Actually, dinosaurs are reptiles, but so are birds. Birds now are actually, now that we know that birds are dinosaurs and dinosaurs are reptiles, birds are actually reptiles in our new classification system. If we look at them even genetically, crocodiles and alligators are more closely related to birds than they are to lizards and snakes and turtles. So our old classification system, basically, which is really obsolete, was invented before anyone knew anything had gone extinct or evolved. And now that we understand evolution and extinction, we know now that animals like birds are actually reptiles.
So we are coming to the edge of a question that someone else is raising here, and that is the subtitle of your book, Extinction Doesn't Have to Be Forever. Does that perhaps apply to human beings as well? Could you somehow, with the internal functioning of a human bone, extract genes, extract whatever you need to maybe recreate that human being?
Well, I think you know, many different kinds of mammals have been cloned. That's a different technique than we're talking about here. And I think that probably most scientists would agree that it would be a technical engineering problem to overcome to clone a human being, but it's much more of an ethical problem. That's not something that's going to happen, I don't think. But one thing that's worth pointing out is that all you can do is reproduce the DNA of an individual. You can't recreate that individual because people are the sum of
so much.
So much.
James Gorman, Jack Horner. The book is titled How to Build a Dinosaur. Extinction doesn't have to be forever. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm at conversation.wamu.org. By the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles at annenbergspaceforphotography.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a doctor's reflections on illness in a high-tech era. We talk with Dr. Robert Martinson about some troubling aspects of the system he describes as a biomedical industrial complex. He's an emergency room physician, medical historian, and bioethicist, and the author of the new book, A Life Worth Living. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Well, I understand I have been had by an April Fool's joke regarding farm-raised whales, which I heard about while I was at Oberlin College in the last few days, and of course did not have my astute producers pointing out the fact that it was an April Fool's joke. So I do apologize. Let's go now to Therese in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. This is a question that consumes my son, who has read, I would say, almost everything that these two gentlemen and what Mary Schweitzer herself has produced, either in written form or in documentary form. And he wants to grow up to be a micro-paleobiologist. I think that's what they call it. He will be getting this book for his 7th birthday. Let me ask the question that consumes him, and that is, how can we resolve the creationist and the evolutionary, because he feels they can be resolved, how can they be resolved, or can they be?
Jack Horner.
Well, now that's a good question. I actually teach a class at Montana State University called Origins, where we have a professor that talks about the origin of the universe, and all the way up to complexity, and then I teach the origin of life and evolution and so forth. And then we have a third person who is a theologian who actually tries to unite the two and talks about this. But the most important thing that your son needs to realize is that that science is actually a process. It actually is it has rules. And the idea really is to try to figure out how things work. And so what we do is we use physical evidence and we make hypotheses. And then we try to prove those hypotheses wrong. When it comes to religion and philosophies, we don't have those same rules. And so it really is very hard to compare the two. But there's certainly no reason that a person can't be a good scientist and still be religious.
I like that line very much. Here's an email from Samuel, who is in Irving, Texas, who says, the idea of creating extinct species seems to clash with the belief of survival of the fittest. Are we going against nature here, Jim?
Well, I think that if we were to try and bring back many, many species and sort of set them up in their original environment, you would be kind of going against what had happened. In fact, there's a very funny routine by George Carlin, the late George Carlin, a comedian, who said, you know, so many species, 95 or whatever percent of the species that have ever existed are extinct. Let them go. But I think that in this case, we're not really talking about that. We're talking about seeing what we can do to see how evolution worked. And I also think sometimes people think that, well, if you could bring back, say, an ivory-billed woodpecker, would that solve the problem? Would we not have to worry about species going extinct? And I don't think so at all, because the real sadness of losing a bird like the ivory bill, if it is extinct, and some people think it isn't, is that you've lost the environment. We cut down the forests. That's what we did that's very sad. And to bring back an individual, it really doesn't solve anything in terms of extinction, of conservation. It answers scientific problems, but it's no answer to the problem of human impact on the environment.
All right, to Norfolk, Virginia. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you. My question, I guess, is, and I'm all for this. You know, we have knowledge. Let's use it. You know, it'd just be a terrible waste. And I'm glad your gentlemen there are looking at these possibilities. My question is, if we can turn genes on and off, selected genes, say, turn this chicken into you know, what we would call a dinosaur, ultimately, wouldn't it just be a freakish chicken with claws and a long tail? I mean, it wouldn't think like a dinosaur or anything like that. We'd learn nothing about dinosaur behavior, would we?
That's correct. It'd still be a still be a chicken. And it'd still be going looking for chicken feed.
But if you went a little farther, couldn't you actually begin to change the behavior of the chicken?
Well, you know, who knows how far we can
go?
I mean, that's the question. You know, we're just beginning to think about, you know, the very basics of, I guess, what we call basic genetic engineering.
And it would not be a freak if you did it right. I mean, people could create a freakish creature by interfering with the embryo. The trick here is to find what the path of evolution was that made the change. So you are really bringing back true characteristics. So you're not creating a freak. You're building or reverse engineering something that is very similar, or the characteristics are really what used to exist. So the creature, depending on how much you change, is still to some extent a chicken, yes, but there's a lot more to it.
All right, to Carol in Rockville, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane, and thank you for all the pro-animal things that you've had to say over the years. My concern listening to these gentlemen talk is actually chickens, not dinosaurs. They talk about so many protections in colleges, for example, when you do scientific research, when virtually there are none. Chickens and other birds do not come under the Animal Welfare Act, so anybody can do anything to a chicken. People that care about chickens, for instance, a group called United Poultry Concerns, have shown that chickens show have knowledge. They're not dumb birds at all. They're not dumb animals. They also have feelings, sentient feelings, and they mother very well, and they love to sit in the treetops when they're rescued. So I really don't think that it's ethical in any way, shape, or form to be talking about this subject when we're talking about doing something with chickens. Chickens aren't a means to an end. Chickens are beings unto themselves. I'm disabled. I've been disabled for about 30 years. My husband is newly disabled, and we support stem cell research for cures for things like Parkinson's and other diseases. However, there has never, to my knowledge, been any progress in experimenting on animals that has done any good for anybody. And in fact, if we did have good research committees looking over different research at universities, we wouldn't have things like the head injury clinic where baboons were injured at the University of Pennsylvania or other problems.
All right,
that.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. Jim?
Well, this is a big subject that we address in the book, the ethics of experimenting on animals. And again, it's something that, you know, everybody has to talk about this and decide. I do think that universities do have, I know at McGill University where Hans Larsen is working on chicken embryos, they have, if the chicken were to hatch, they would have a university committee to decide on the welfare of the chicken. Now, you may disagree, and I think people can disagree on the value of these experiments. I think that they certainly can and have in the past done things that are useful for people. But to me, it's a case-by-case situation, and it's something that is really, again, it's not for scientists to decide. It's for a big public conversation about the value of these experiments.
Here's an email from Maggie who says, what kind of scientific resistance are you encountering at the prospect of opening this Pandora's box?
Well, we don't have any yet. I mean, but then we haven't produced a chicken either.
How close are you?
Well, that's a good question. Some people have suggested that we're within 5 years of making a chickenosaurus.
A chickenosaurus.
Well, that's, you know, we don't know what to call this thing.
And this would look as you described, with a longer tail, because you have manipulated this one gene that right. affects the growth of the tail. It would also have different front.
Hands. It would have hands, basically.
It would have hands. And what other differences would one note?
That's about all.
Teeth.
With another gene, we could have teeth. Yep.
I see. Would it know how to behave, reproduce?
Certainly it would. I mean, that wouldn't be changed. It would, in that sense, it would be a chicken. Then, as you say, you can keep going further. I mean, there are changes in the hip structure that you wouldn't necessarily see. You could, if you wanted to, work on those genes. There are a variety of small changes that you could make to get it as close as you can. And as more and more is learned about dinosaurs, from the paleontological point of view, you can look for the characteristics that you want to change. So far, Hans Larsen in his lab has extended the growth of the tail a little bit, and he has gone back. So that's clearly, you know, it's possible to do that. What he's done now is he's gone back, and it, at the moment looking for more funding, but gone back to set up the a baseline so that he knows at every point in the growth of the tail what the genes are being expressed and what the products are at every part of the tail, so that you essentially have the whole program down. Then you know where to go in and change it.
And his science community has not registered any objections yet.
No, these are, for scientists, I think, these are all very unremarkable things to do. I mean, these are within, it's very remarkable if you can achieve what's called an experimental atavism, if you can get the growth of the tail. But working with an embryo, trying to change the growth of it, these are not things that scientists are likely to, I think, resist. The question might be, do we want to put money in this, or do we want to put money in something else? That would be the nature of the question, I think.
Jack?
No, I agree. I mean, that's it really isn't. There's nothing out of the ordinary for, I mean, this is what evolutionary development scientists do.
Except that people have not yet successfully, there have been attempts and little bits of experimental atavisms, but nothing like what this would be.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to, let's see, Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Mark.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Your guests have assured us that these decisions are not made by scientists alone, that they are the result of decisions made by a society through its social structures. And thankfully, that works pretty well in this country. But I'm concerned about the possibility of scientists who might have the possibility to make these decisions in places where those social structures are not in place, where they're not stable, and also concerned because history certainly has taught us that sometimes societies make decisions to do what we now would say is ethically unthinkable, the Holocaust being an obvious example. I'll take my response off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jack.
Well, that's certainly, you know, it is a concern what other countries think about, but the research is going on in other countries as well, and hopefully there is something the scientific community can at least control.
I think all knowledge presents danger and dangerous possibilities, and scientists ask questions and try and understand how the world works. Anytime you understand a process, you can do things with that. I mean, this has been true with atomic energy. This is true with genetic engineering. Scientists themselves have decided they don't want to try to clone human beings. That's well understood. People may do that somewhere else. I don't know. There's not really an answer to, I mean, it's possible that somebody could try that somewhere where the restrictions weren't so strong, although most of science has decided that that's not something they want to do. But the alternative of saying, well, I'm not going to look into this area because I might find something that could be bad, that would be so antithetical to the idea of understanding how the world works. I don't know exactly how you would do that. I mean, scientists do gather in committees, like in 1974 when genetic engineering just started, there was the Asilomar conference where scientists set rules for themselves about what was ethical to do. And they still set rules. People may not agree with them, but there is an attempt.
What comes next after the longer tail and the hand?
Well, that's a good question. And a lot of this genetic engineering really is attempts to figure out how genetics works, how the genes work, how to turn them on, how to turn them off. And obviously we have lots of genetic diseases that we hope that we can deal with. As far as our Chickenosaurus goes, that's a good question. I think that if we are able to make a chickenosaurus, and that it's a happy chickenosaurus, then maybe we can go a little bit further and make, make a bigger one.
Jack Horner and James Gorman, their book is titled How to Build a Dinosaur. Extinction doesn't have to be forever. Fascinating topic. And I don't know whether to wish you all success or not, but very interesting. Thank you both.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.